Hello and welcome to the Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to pick up with Revelo P. Oliver and his America's Decline, The Education of a Conservative, and we're going to do a fairly short segment, or comparatively short, and it's going to cover some two or three reviews that he did. Now, let's dig in. A very liberal conscience. Again, this stuff was written in the 50s and 60s. The Hiroshima pilot, a very liberal conscience. The Hiroshima pilot by William Bradford Huey, H-U-I-E. The quote-unquote liberal mind, and again, he always puts liberal in quotations, is a weird and wonderful thing. On May 11, 1940, the government of Great Britain decided to overthrow the conventions of civilized warfare and revert to the unmitigated ferocity of primeval savagery. They calculated that if they could bomb and kill enough of the helpless civilian population of defenseless German cities, they could eventually force the Germans to bomb and kill enough of the helpless civilian population of undefended British cities to whip up enthusiasm for a war that most Britons felt to be the wrong war declared at the wrong time. And that's true. That's what the Jews paid Churchill to do. That is practically his first act as Prime Minister, was to start civilian bombing of Germany at the Jews' request. They paid off his debts. He initiated a world war. This brilliant strategy succeeded. Of course, the British raids were kept secret, and the captive press in both England and the United States screeched most horribly about German barbarism when the Germans finally began to retaliate. But the members of the British government who devised that grand strategy were much too proud of themselves to hide their inspiring light under a bushel for long, and in April of 1944, the principal secretary of the Air Ministry, J.M. Speight, S-P-A-I-G-H-T, published, with the approval of his superiors, a book entitled Bombing Vindicated, in which he boasted of the, quote, splendid decision as an, quote, heroic act which prepared in advance benefits which the noble communists reaped when they finally got into the war. That official boast has never been retracted. Now, I do not recall ever having heard a cheep from a, quote, unquote, liberal about that. Our big brains, presumably, think it's just perfectly splendid when a government arranges for the mass slaughter of its own people. It seems likely, then, that all liberals believe that white Europeans are almost as expendable as white Americans, of whom the more killed the better. The most efficient manifestation of Anglo-American humanitarianism, of course, was the famous saturation raid on Dresden, in which, in just a few hours, we were able to slaughter 135,000 women, children, and other non-combatants, maim for life almost as many more, and obliterate the residential part of the city, taking precautions to avoid serious damage to the few legitimate military targets in the area. The most recent work on this subject is David Irving's The Destruction of Dresden. That's where he got the 135,000 number. Liberals, of course, think it was a jolly fine deed. In fact, simply ripping old Trump a what? On August 6, 1945, we carried out a much smaller raid on Hiroshima in Japan. Only half as many people were killed as at Dresden, and most of these were killed as mercifully as possible, i.e. instantly. The only thing which made the operation noteworthy was that a single atomic bomb had been used. Now, an atomic bomb, although much more expensive, weighs much less than the number of ordinary explosive bombs that would be needed to produce the same effect. Military men accordingly noted that the improved bomb made it possible to produce, under favorable conditions, a given amount of damage with fewer airplanes and less expenditure of gasoline. The efficiency of the new weapon created some panic among the Japanese, who had suffered far more horrible raids and had been trying for some time to surrender, which of course they could not be permitted to do until the Soviet was ready to occupy Manchuria and so obtain a base for the projected conquest of our ally China. Still, no one else was much excited at the time. But When hostilities ceased, it was obvious that the United States had exclusive control of an extraordinarily powerful weapon, and there was danger that the nasty Americans might want to use it to impede the international communist conspiracy's conquest of the world, including, eventually, the United States. It was then that our liberals felt a pricking sensation in that cranium, which they identified as conscience, and they rushed into our streets yelling bloody murder. And they began that fantastic cavorting and yammering about nuclear holocausts, world peace, and similar asininities that they have kept up to the present day. And these are political social issues in the 50s and 60s. And he's pointing out their hypocrisy. Sometime in 1958, the noisy neurotics began to tell us about one Major Claude Etherly, who had dropped a bomb in Hiroshima and was so conscience-stricken by his crime against humanity, in quotes, that he woke up screaming at night and rushed out into barns to sob amid the new mown hay. And soon the hullabaloo got under. Newspapers and periodicals filled their troughs with the tripe that is infallibly appetizing to humanitarians. Communist fronters orated. Books were written. Plays were staged. Cinemas were produced. And a gullible congressman even made a speech about the poor major who carried our guilt on his swollen conscience. The second act came when the tender-minded major tried to expiate his awful guilt by forging checks, burglarizing post offices, and once, in a moment of courage, holding up a grocer at the point of a pistol. In the form that this story is dished out in liberal sheets abroad, it is stated that the United States is afflicted with nasty fascists and warmongers who, disapproving of the major's little efforts to show how much his conscience hurts, placed him under restraint. That made him, quote, the American Dreyfus. Imaginary Jew, French victim around 1900. Mr. Huey decided to investigate the tear-jerking yarn, and the present book is his report. If you have much experience of the liberal mentality, I need not tell you that the story is just a hoax. There is a Claude Etherly, or Etherly, who was a major in the Air Force until the Air Force decided that it could manage without him. He had nothing to do with dropping the bomb on either Hiroshima or Nagasaki, which was soon included for good measure. But he did make a flight over Hiroshima in one of the planes that was sent over Japan at high altitude to observe the weather. He has distinguished himself in civilian life with quite a number of little forgeries, burglaries, and the like, and has even helped smuggle guns to Cuba, but only in a clerical capacity, in this country where there is no risk of suffering skin abrasions, and he says that he is a pacifist and wants atomic weapons abolished because he feels so guilty about what he says he did in Japan. So far as we can tell from the record, if the major's posturings had any origin other than a disinclination to work and a bonus from a liberal journalist, the source of his distress was that the stupid Air Force had not included him in the crew of the plane that did drop the bomb on Hiroshima, thus depriving him of a pleasant adventure and an opportunity for some truthful publicity. This is a detailed account of an elaborate and influential imposture, although what may have originated in the mind of one man was knowingly prepared, propagated over the whole world by legions of scribblers, barkers, and artists for the benefit of the Bolsheviks. But it will do no good to show the book to real liberal. His mind is permanently insulated against the facts. That's from September 1964, talking about early atomic bomb propaganda, one worldism. Next up, these are going to be shorter pieces than what we've been having before, and we're only going to do about 12 pages today, so it'll take about 30, 40 minutes. A beneficent socialism. L'état jésuit du Paraguay by Louis Baudin. Baudin. A beneficent socialism. The Jesuit State of Paraguay by Louis Baudin. There must be many persons who are sincerely convinced of the merits of socialism. That is what I am told, and I want to believe it, and, well, with a little effort, I do believe it. The only thing that gives me pause is the extreme care that those persons seem to exercise to avoid learning anything about socialism. They pep themselves up with futurist novels such as Edward Bellamy's Looking Backwards. That was a very, very widely published famous bestseller at the late age. Looking Backwards by Edward Bellamy, which would rank with Edgar Rice Burroughs' Martian Stories. That's the Tarzan guy. I guess he also did Martian Stories. If it were better written, or with the even more fantastic promises of pie in the sky that conspiratorial organizations such as the Fabians concoct to make materialist mouths water. And as I said last time, the Fabian is socialism by degree, democratically, nonviolently, versus Marxist socialism, which is by revolution and violently. Fabianism versus Marxism. The innocent socialist read volumes of that stuff and can tell you, if you have a few days to listen, all about socialist theories from Saint Simon to Norman Thomas. And these are the early utopian socialists preceded Marx and the so-called scientific socialism. None of them are scientific. None of them are possible. They're all absurd. And when they were tried, they foundered. But socialism, as it has existed in the world of reality, of socialism, they know nothing. They seem never to have heard of it. Socialism, by which we mean the control of a people's economic life by a centralized government, is, of course, the oldest form of human society that can be called civilized. It appeared fully formed in the barbaric monarchies of the early Orient. For a profound study of its origin and development, see Carl K. A. Wittfogel's Oriental Despotism. The most perfect example of a socialist state, perfect because the state was completely isolated geographically from possible rivals, and we therefore need make no allowance for foreign invasions, foreign wars, or even foreign competition, was the Empire of the Incas in South America, which was lucidly described and ably studied by Professor Baudin, the world's foremost scholar in that field. In L'Empire Socialiste des Incas, the Socialist Empire of the Incas, which is also available in Spanish, El Imperio Socialista de los Incas, it may be that men had to pass through socialism before they could advance to higher forms of culture. It is certainly true that more highly civilized states relapse into socialism when moral rot and democracy have destroyed their national cohesion, or I would just say the IQ dips and the population becomes colored, as we see this Ocasio-Cortez and the general brainlessness of the Green New Deal was the timely thing when I read this to you in 2019 early. But socialism, wherever and however it appears, necessarily entails the reduction of virtually the whole population to the status of livestock, of whom their owners, if wise, will take good care, just as prudent farmers consider the welfare of their cows and horses. In all of the world's history, so far as I know, there has been just one socialist state that did operate for the welfare of its population rather than the profit and amusement of its rulers. And I have yet to meet a socialist who has even heard, however vaguely, of that state. That state was located in a region which is now divided between Paraguay, Argentina, and Brazil. It was the product of an exceptional combination of factors that is not likely ever to recur. It is, however, the only known instance of a socialism that could be described as humane, and as such should command the attention of everyone interested in socialism as a form of social organization rather than as a means of undermining and destroying Western civilization. What is now the small province of Misiones in Argentina, together with strips of adjacent territory in Paraguay and Brazil, has fertile soil and a temperate climate. In this region, from 1638 to 1750, existed the optimum conditions for the operation of a successful socialism, viz., a large and docile population of a physically distinct and obviously inferior race, and a small body of capable administrators of a physically distinct and obviously superior race. And what makes the combination absolutely unique, those administrators were genuinely self-sacrificing. 1. The Guarani Indians were by no means at the bottom of the scale of human races. They were superior to the inhabitants of many independent states that are members of the United Nations, both of those in quotes. They were innately lazy, shiftless, and somewhat stupid. They were savages with no permanent family relationships and no conception of private property other than in bits of clothing they were wearing or the spear they held in their hand. They were completely feckless. If provided with seed and taught to cultivate the soil, they would, if left to themselves, consume the entire harvest, for their primitive minds would not think of saving seed for next year's planting. But they seem not to have been innately vicious. They were easily domesticated and, in the hands of the Jesuits, became docile. They were brave and, when trained and commanded by the Jesuits, made excellent soldiers to the astonishment of the whole world. 2. The Jesuit fathers were not only members of a superior race, but belonged to a small minority within that race. As a body, they were drawn from the most intelligent part of the European population, and they had received a rigorous and thorough education. That education reflected, in large part, the Renaissance ideal of the homo universal, the universal man. They were good Latinists and swordsmen. They knew the essentials of architecture and music. They were acquainted with the etiquette of polite society and military tactics, and above all, they knew how to learn whatever they might need to know for the task to which they were assigned. And naturally, the Jesuits who were sent by the general of their order to Paraguay understood the task before them, and E. Michael Jones has used this example, this exact same example of the Jesuits in basically in Paraguay and their ability to create civilization out of raw hominids, proving that to them that race doesn't matter. They just need 1,000 years, and they were interrupted and it was destroyed, but he, the atheist, is agreeing with them that they were able to do something. So that's another way to look at this, another treatment of it. There was no idiotic twaddle about equality. As Julius Cordara, who is certainly the most learned and acute of the Jesuits of the 18th century, put it, the Guaranis were fertis bestiis quam hominibus similares. So something like feral beasts that look like men, it might be translated. The Jesuits, however, firmly believed that those subhumans had divinely created souls, which were to be saved by religious rites and the imposition of moral conduct. Again, E. Michael Jones, no progress outside the moral order, so they're going to bring moral order to the savages. That was the task to which the Jesuits sent to Paraguay were assigned, and with remarkable efficiency and unassuming heroism, they, armed with authority from the King of Spain, proceeded to carry it out. The Jesuits, furthermore, were disinterested men, of a kind that the world is not likely to see again. Vowed to celibacy, they could have no thought of establishing and advancing families. Vowed to absolute obedience to their general, the only personal ambition open to them was to rise in the order, and since the general might any day send any or all of them to the other end of the earth, no one of them could think of establishing a personal power. And each firmly believed that the sacrifice of his own life, whether in a moment of martyrdom at the hands of the savages or in years of humble labor for the benefit of his inferiors, was in obedience to the inscrutable decrees of God. With amazing self-sacrifice, with courage and humility, with just the right combination of persuasion and coercion, the Jesuits settled the Guaranis in villages, set them to work cultivating fields and building churches and houses, and regulated their whole lives to do each day. The Jesuits sent their wards to work in the morning, called them in the afternoon, and set them to singing, dancing, and playing approved games, and then sent them to bed at the proper hour. So they treated them like children. The products of the fields and the workshops went to community warehouses to be dispensed to the population as the fathers thought best, or to be exported and traded for whatever the community needed and could not yet manufacture for itself. Who had reached the age of 17, and the females who were 15 were assembled and mated. The Jesuits permitted no other white men to enter their territory, except a few inconvenient but privileged visitors who carried letters from the King of Spain. It is beyond question that the Jesuits gave the Guaranis a life far happier than any they had known before or were to know afterward. In 1750, the stupid King of Spain, as part of a treaty devised, as usual, by experts, quote-unquote, gave the Jesuit territory to Portugal. The Jesuits, unwilling to see the liquidation of the little state they had established and made to function so well, resisted, and they had trained their native troops with such efficiency that it required the combined armies of Spain and Portugal to defeat them. And that victory cost so much that the pertinent part of the Treaty of 1750 was abrogated. In 1767, on orders from Madrid, the Jesuits were arrested by treachery and deported with utmost inhumanity. That was only a few years before the whole order was suppressed and outlawed by the Pope. And today the Jesuits are completely a homosexual fifth column within the church, is what E. Michael Jones says. And he knows, like, the one of them who's not a queer. But that's a rather different story. Interesting, though. Their magazine is America. I used to read that when I was in college. I would read a lot of socialist garbage and just about everything because it was new and interesting. So the Jesuits ended, they were basically fought and destroyed, and then their whole order was ended not too long afterward. The Aborigines, of course, reverted to barbarism. Families disappeared, alcohol was imported, and a large part of the population either killed one another or drank themselves to death. In this little booklet of Professor Baudin, who is a member of the Institut de France and one of the world's foremost ethnologists, has used his great literary skill to condense into a few pages the essentials of the whole story of the world's only socialist regime that was both successful and humane. The Jesuits in essentially Paraguay. That review appeared in March 1965. I'm assuming most of these appeared in American Opinion, the JBS organ. Sailing between Scylla and Charybdis, the original rock in a hard place, you could say. The publisher, who is responsible for the final selection of items to be included in this collection, has decided to reprint one in which I had some difficulty in maintaining critical integrity without violating the courtesy due to a colleague, and a woman at that. In 1965, Mrs. Marcus Reback, R-E-B-A-C-K, or Taylor Caldwell, I guess her pen name, was a regular contributor to American Opinion, Mrs. Marcus Reback, and the pride and joy of the birch business. There was no end to the ideological billing and cooing between her and Robert Welch, both of whom pressured me for a blurb to be put in the jacket of her forthcoming novel about Cicero. Since I had never seen her manuscript, I refused to follow the fairly common practice of supplying such an endorsement, sight unseen, and when I finally received the advance sheets, I still refused, but I supplied the authoress with a list of about 300 of the more grotesque anachronisms in her book. By then, it was too late to make corrections, she said. Had the novel been worthless, I should have refused to notice it, but it was both useful and a dangerous as conservative, quote-unquote, propaganda. It was both useful and dangerous as conservative propaganda. Mrs. Reback, R-E-B-A-C-K, was a highly competent, indeed an expert, writer of fiction with scores of bestsellers to her credit. She wrote a fluid and vivid English which sometimes attained stylistic distinction. Her story, considered abstractly for its plot and characters, as we would consider one of Edgar Rice Burroughs's Tales of Adventure on Mars or Clark Ashton Smith's story, stories about the imaginary continent of Zothique, was excellent. So she's a good writer. As an allegory, describing the present under a transparent veil of fiction, it had great force. But as an historical novel, even when one allowed for a novelist's obvious need to invent characters, situations, and conversation, it was deplorable. The number of ignorant and unnecessary anachronisms was shocking, and I gave a few examples in my article to alert readers who might otherwise be complacent. Worse than that, the book came close to being a calculated hoax. It is, of course, a common device in fiction to lend greater verisimilitude to a story by pretending that it comes from some authentic source. William Meinhold, for example, made his famous tale, Die Bernstein-Hexe, or The Amber Witch, more vivid with a prefatory claim that it was transcribed from a 17th century manuscript, but he intended to deceive no one, although his writing was so impeccable, stylistically and historically, that some of his contemporaries refused to believe that he was really the author. On the other hand, Sir Walter Scott intended only to amuse his readers by an editorial claim that The Black Dwarf and Old Mortality were authentic records taken down by Jebediah Cleishbotham, the schoolmaster of Gondercleuch. Mrs. Reebok, however, went far beyond literary license. In her foreword, after brazenly claiming that she found and read in the Vatican Library and the Vatican Archives, various ancient books that had been lost for 15 centuries or more, and quite a few that were never written, and asserting that she had translated Cicero's own statements, she avers that 9 years of research, enabled her to write what was virtually a biography of Cicero. "I intrude none of my own opinions. I merely present Marcus Tullius Cicero and his world for the reader's own judgment and conclusions." End quote. The truth of the matter is that a woman who makes elementary blunders in the simplest inflection, such as those I politely described as slips of the pen in my article, could not have read a single sentence in Latin. Her sources were two or three of the scores of books about Cicero that have been published in English in recent years, and she had the luck or taste to select good ones, and her own fertile imagination. Of this, I discreetly warned readers, but I underestimated the credulity of the ganders in our klutsch, or church. I'm not sure what klutsch means. It must be some kind of a Scottish-type word. Village, maybe. I did not then imagine that I would eventually see dozens of conservative books, articles, and other publications, even including publishers' catalogs, adorned with quotations from Mrs. Reebok, all coyly attributed to Cicero, with the implication that the learned authors have themselves translated the gems from Cicero's Latin. Oddly enough, the most popular of the spurious quotations is one of the most preposterous anachronisms. Cicero is made to say, in a passage that Mrs. Reebok specifically claimed to have translated from his De Republica, quote, "We are taxed in our bread and our wine, in our incomes and our investments, on our land and on our property." EQS. All that at a time when the Romans and all other inhabitants of Italy paid no direct taxes whatsoever, and no indirect taxes, except what was included in the cost of goods imported from the provinces. The most reprehensible of all the anachronisms, however, are the grotesque falsifications introduced on behalf of the Jews and Christians. So far as I recall, Cicero made only two significant references to the Jews. In his oration Pro Flacco, 28.66-69, he mentioned the vast corruption of political affairs at Rome that had been wrought by the swarming colony of enemy aliens in the city, who had attained formidable power by intrigue, bribery, and financial manipulations, including the device by which, under the cover of their barbarous superstition, they created financial panics. In De Provindis Consularibus, he alluded in passing to their notorious lack of self-respect and honor. In his philosophical discussion, socially and politically indispensable, he mentioned various Oriental cults, but never the bizarre rites of the Jews, although he must have known a good deal about the beliefs and pretenses of the international race that had its enclaves in every city and town of the Roman Empire, wherever there was money to be made out of the natives, and perpetually made trouble wherever its members lodged themselves. But Mrs. Reebok had the effrontery to tell her readers in both the novel and the ostensibly documentary foreword that a Jewish financier was Cicero's pal and mentor, and it so filled him with superstition that he learned the Jews' dialect of Canaanite so that he could read God's own words. Capital G-O-W. Quote, "He was deeply involved in Judean theology," Mrs. Reebok assures us with never a blush, and, quote, "he longed to see the incarnation prophesied by King David and Isaiah and others of the mighty Israelite prophets." And not content with that breathtaking hoax, She goes on to aver that Cicero, in one of the letters she discovered in the Vatican Library, quote, certainly describes the world in a nuclear holocaust, presumably having acquired mantic powers by introduction from the Jewish ranting that he read in the Semitic dialect that most of the Jews of his time could not have read themselves. Their only common language was the Greek koine, K-Y-N-E. In my article, I had to call attention to these travesties of history, but I charitably refrained from remarking on the intended deception. I awarded praise where it was deserved and devoted most of the space to correcting tacitly the impression of Cicero that unwary readers might otherwise have derived from the novel. I heard, however, that my want of mendacity had displeased both Welch and the novelist, whom I had treated as kindly as I could, but I flatter myself that my article on my list of anachronisms did influence one of her later works. Years before, a female novelist of considerable talent, Joan Grant, boosted the sales of her historical romances by remembering that they were recounting her sensational experiences in some of her earlier lives. And in doing so, she produced another bestseller for Doctrines of Metempsychosis. I guess that just means rebirth, have always had a particular appeal to the religiosity of our race. In 1956, a hypnotist named Bernstein hit the jackpot with a report that he had introduced a hypnotized housewife to remember that she had been Bridie Murphy, and quite a few other people. A million copies of his book were purchased by persons who had an itch for psychic, quote-unquote, wonderment. It was only to be expected that, after a suitable interval, Mrs. Reebok would see what reincarnation could do for her. In her part of The Search for a Soul, Taylor Caldwell's Psychic Lives, Mrs. Reebok stoutly protests that she does not believe in metempsychosis because she is a, quote, traditionalist Catholic, and because she does not even believe in the existence of an immortal soul. And while thus protecting her personal reputation, she writes so vividly of the hardships and sorrows of her own long and unhappy life that even I felt a twinge of compassion. The rest of the book, according to the title page, was written by one Jess Stern, who took Mrs. Reebok to an enterprising hypnotist and stood by with a tape recorder while she, in a long series of trances, recalled her adventures during the past 20,000 years or so. A painstaking investigator, Stern then verified much of what she said in her trances by escorting her to the shops of various psychics, who obligingly confirmed the details by consulting their friends among the spooks, or the stars, that have recorded for all eternity the transmigrations of the novelist's vagabond soul. Interesting, because around this time, who was it? Hunter S. Thompson used "my gypsy soul." Pretty famous line. I wonder if he got it from Oliver or vice versa. That's how originality works, a slight emanation or alteration. In 37 lives, Mrs. Reebok experienced every kind of fate that can befall a woman. She was, for example, a pathetic scullery maid who was raped by the members of the Hellfire Club. She was the favorite concubine of Genghis Khan. She was a great empress named Aisha, similar to, but not identical with, Aisha of Rider Haggard's novels, who ruled over a vast continent that was engulfed by the ocean. But she did not remember having been in bed with Cicero. That pleases me. So he's having fun with some of the bullshit put out there. Now, I'm actually going to split it here. It's not the overly most natural split, but I hadn't realized that that was a prelude to this long piece on Cicero. We've already gone long enough today, so we'll do the article Cicero and Taylor Caldwell next time. For now, we'll finish with some notes to what we just read above. Just another half page or so, not too much, and then we'll call that a session. Notes. 1. Five gross errors, none of which have been overlooked by anyone with a smattering of Latin, make almost unintelligible the passage on page 435 of her book, which she carelessly copied from some edition of Sallust or some modern who quoted and translated it. 2. And there are just three of these, I believe. For a concise exposition of this imposture on human credulity, see Dr. Martin Gardner's Fads and Fallacies in the Name of Science, New York, 1968, available in a Dover reprint. The housewife was probably like Mrs. Reebok, whose psychic memories obviously came from her reading of English fiction and wonder books, somewhat embellished by her own vivid imagination. 3. I cannot begin to catalog the revelations contained in this wonder book. The cultists of British Israel will be delighted with evidence that Jesus must have been an Anglo-Saxon. That's the forerunner that produced Christian identity, the garbage belief that whites are the real Jews. Mrs. Reebok, who was an eyewitness and who predicted his birth when she was the mother of Mary Magdalene, remembers that he had long golden beard and blue eyes, while his mother, the other Mary, was a gorgeous blonde. Mormons will rejoice that when Mrs. Reebok was a Mayan Inca, sick, in the Western Hemisphere, she knew the white god who gave the angel Moroni the golden plates from which Joseph Smith translated the Book of Mormon, with the aid of his magic stone monocle, his seer stone. Students of English literature should note that Mrs. Reebok was an overworked and cruelly abused slave in the household of Marianne Evans, who is better known as George Eliot, the writer, the novelist, and whose ghost, as observed by expert spook seers, now hovers about Mrs. Reebok to provide literary help when needed. A section of the book was devoted to advertising Mrs. Reebok's next novel, in which she was going to narrate her life in Periclean Athens, where she was Helena, a call girl in a service operated by Pericles' mistress, Aspasia. The call girl became a female physician whose medical discoveries placed the pathologist of Athens far ahead of their rivals in Alexandria, which, by the way, was founded a century after the death of Pericles. Remember Athens' golden age with Pericles. The psychics are also well informed about Mrs. Reebok's future lives after the nuclear holocaust, which God has scheduled for the year 2002. She will appear in a brand new incarnation as a savioress who will convert the battered world to spiritual values. My younger readers should remember to watch for her epiphany. So he's having some fun with woman's inability. She has literary ability. She can write fiction, but she can't think clearly, and her imagination and her honesty contrive to produce absurd anachronisms, some of which he delicately pointed out. Anyway, that will do it for today. I want to thank you for being with me. I'm Alex Linder. I've been reading to you from Revelo Oliver's America's Decline, The Education of a Conservative. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com, and I'll be back with you again real soon.